Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, August 2nd. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Second week in a row, Ethan, thanks for making the trip down to Woods Hole.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times and speak with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Ethan, let's start this week with the tornado aftermath. It's another fine distinction, but the National Weather Service has retroactively changed its description of what happened in the July 23rd storms. The agency now says three tornadoes touched down on the Cape, not two, as they said previously, and not one, as they said initially. For those dealing with the destruction, homeowners, small business owners may not make a whole lot of difference, but it does mean that in about a half an hour, we saw as many tornadoes as the Cape had previously seen in all its official weather history going all the way back, which is something to think about. Meanwhile, the state announced some efforts to help local businesses. Tell us about this.
Yeah, like you said, I don't think businesses care if it was one, two, three, or a dozen. The damage was done the same. The state officials this week announced that there's going to be a $1 million small business emergency loan fund for businesses. So if you think about it, if you're a restaurant and your power went out and then all of your food went bad because you can't hold on to it because you didn't have power, this can help pay for some of that. So they're starting to offer that. The loans are going to range between $5,000 and $50,000. So, I mean, you got a little bit of room there. And a lot of it's to get places where you're kind of humming right now. You need all of the business you can.
This is the moment.
Yeah, squeeze that orange for all you can get. Just keep you up and running and get you through the rest of this.
And Chamber of Commerce pointing out here that a lot of small businesses don't have what's called interruption insurance. So they have just enough insurance to carry them through the summer, but they're not expecting to be interrupted by something like this. And as you say, you might have food in the freezers that's going bad, or they not able to work for 5 days or 3 or 5 days as all that power was out, and they're still looking to pay their employees to hold on to them.
Yeah, and a lot you also have to bring in your employees for times like that. And then if you think the next day, you have to do all the ordering early. You have to get people in to prep even earlier. One of the restaurants I had talked to previously said they had to bring in people hours early just to do all the prep work because they needed to get tons of new food and redo everything. So, yeah, I mean, it's a thing that it's going to be tough to kind of get going. And once you lose a few days when you only have 70 or so for some of these businesses, every day really counts. This is kind of a thing to get people back up on their feet. There's going to be no payments for the first 30 days. You got a 5-month period of interest only payments, and interest rate is set at 3%, I believe.
So because the storm happened at the height of the tourist season, for many of these businesses, the money that they earn in this 70-day period, as you say, is part of what carries them the whole rest of the year. And every one of those days, you can imagine, is so important for them. Meantime, the Chamber of Commerce is also getting some money, and this is a separate pot of money here.
Yeah, they're getting money from the Travel and Tourism Office, the state one. It's a $100,000 grant, basically to boost awareness that the Cape is still open for business. If you follow any of our state officials on Twitter or any kind of social media, they have been in real Chamber of Commerce mode. A lot of people saying the Cape is open for business is kind of a rallying call I've seen quite a bit of lately. Trying to get people, I think because you see a lot of headlines lately, and especially in Boston media, is beaches are closed because of sharks and this and that.
Tornadoes and heat wave and yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the Chamber of Commerce is trying to push back against that a little bit. I think even Wendy Northcross, the CEO, is saying August is looking good, but the constant bad news and headlines, you have to kind of counter that, and that's what we're trying to counter. Mm-hmm.
And so the Chamber has gotten this $100,000 to launch a new marketing campaign, and that is already underway. And this kind of comes on the heels, too, of a report that already things have been a little bit soft or a little bit slow this summer for a lot of businesses on the Cape. So they're trying to reset the narrative there. You took a look this week at federal funding, which may be coming our way to help with tornado recovery.
Yeah, actually, it was last week, last Friday. A bunch of state officials and even federal officials, Senator Markey, had come down and they had talked about what they could do to try and help out. One of the things is they are looking to get federal disaster aid. And one of the things you need to do is calculate the amount of damage that has been done in the area. So one of the things is the threshold to qualify for disaster aid is $9.6 million. So one of the things that are ongoing right now is all the towns are kind of tallying up what happened, what's the damage, what was the cost incurred here, to see if it meets that threshold. So that's kind of the thing that's ongoing right now.
And in the article, a number of different officials kind of saying, oh, we think it'll meet the threshold. Is that kind of the thought here?
That was the thought initially. I'm checking in right now to talk to everybody and see kind of where things are. A lot of towns kind of have some preliminary estimates. I talked to Yarmouth yesterday. They said just the town municipal impact was calculating up around $1 million. I believe Harwich is higher. I believe Dennis is around there. So it still remains to be seen exactly how much. So what happens is the towns report their things to the state. The state will then make a request of the federal government, and then ultimately it goes up to Mr. Trump about how this gets decided if they want to declare disaster aid.
So that in the end, the federal aid decision is made by the president.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
I want to mention a story for which we don't have a lot of detail yet. Yesterday, Saoirse Kennedy Hill, granddaughter of Robert and Ethel Kennedy, was pronounced dead at Cape Cod Hospital. She was 22. She was staying at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport, where emergency responders were called yesterday afternoon. A number of news outlets, including the Associated Press, the New York Times, reporting this as an apparent overdose. Saoirse Hill was a student at Boston College. It's a sad story, and our thoughts go out to the family there. Ethan, let's talk about Yarmouth now. The Yarmouth Select Board voted this week to drop a lawsuit against its own school board. It's a big deal coming after months and months of acrimony with the town of Dennis over their regional school district.
Yeah, so for people who aren't familiar with that mid-Cape area there, Dennis and Yarmouth share a school district together, and there's been an ongoing tug of war over a new regional middle school. Yarmouth has been not crazy about this new middle school, which was approved at the polls, and the selectmen filed a lawsuit against the school committee. So basically,
essentially arguing that the way that they made the decision for this, they took issue with.
Yeah, they said the way they went about approving the funding for this new school was not the way you're supposed to do it. That was not the way Barnstable Superior Court judge viewed it, and he dismissed it. But later it was they had noticed they were going to appeal. So where this all kind of fits is the Mass School Building Authority will give you funding. They'll give you basically a reimbursement for projects. And one of the issues is if there's any threat of this kind of litigation, they need all parties to be on board.
Yes.
And with one of the two towns basically – the more populous town,
the other,
even,
or their own school district. Yes.
Yeah, there's obviously some issues. So they have basically, they even have given the towns a couple extra deadline extensions, and they said, you're not getting a third one. So this was, I mean, it's hours before this. There was a deadline at midnight earlier this week. So just hours before that, and Yarmouth decided we're going to drop this. And one of the big things is kind of Yarmouth isn't crazy about the regional agreement. So what happens is currently the amount that each town pays for the school district, so you're talking construction costs and annual school district costs, is determined by the enrollment. And right now, Yarmouth, their enrollment is staggeringly higher than Dennis. They're at 71%. Dennis is at 29%. So you have this kind of imbalance in the amount of students. So there's an agreement on the table, I believe, it in the settlement that basically said, for this project, Dennis is going to pay 35%, even though they only have 29% of the students.
Of the construction costs here, yeah.
Yeah, for the new middle school. And Yarmouth is going to pay 65%. So kind of centering the scales a little more.
And part of the thought is that some of these, like, the parts of the school just have to be used by everywhere, and by everyone, rather, the offices and the cafeteria and the library. So they should be splitting those costs a little more fairly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Yarmouth's thing has been, we're kind of almost entirely the school district, but you guys still have quite a bit of say in what goes on. So it's kind of this imbalance that they feel is ongoing. And they want to get this regional agreement between the two. They want it to be updated every 5 years. There's some stipulations about the amount of payment for students going to other schools that are inside the district. So you still pay for them, even if they go to outside of the district to a separate school.
So for folks who have been following this story for months and months, the fact that the Yarmouth Select Board essentially withdrew its appeal at the last minute, just hours before the deadline, as you say, this is a big deal because now this project looks like it's going to move forward, and it looks like they're going to be able to get the $44 million from the state as a reimbursement towards building this new school.
It does, but there could be a catch here, as there always is with anything with the Dennis Yarmouth schools. A couple residents of Yarmouth, Tom Sullivan, who's actually, I believe, the father of a school committee member, and Vita Morris, who, if you've ever been to any of the school committee meetings, she is a constant a resident there. So they have filed a lawsuit basically arguing the same argument that the selectmen did, saying the agreement didn't go through right. They didn't approve this project the way they were supposed to. And no one's quite sure yet if that's going to change things, if that counts as an issue or not. All of this is very dependent on the school building authority, because the towns can't afford to build this without that $44 million reimbursement. So to be determined.
So we'll be talking about this again, I'm
absolutely
sure. A new level in shark detection technology has arrived off Cape Beaches. It uses buoys to alert lifeguards if a tagged great white passes nearby. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so last weekend over at Newcomb Hollow Beach, which famously was the latest sighting of a fatal shark attack last year, they put out this buoy. So if a shark that has been tagged, which there's
171.
Yeah, 171 sharks have been tagged. So basically, if one of those tagged sharks goes within a certain vicinity of that buoy, it'll get pinged up and people will be alerted about it. There's still some questions about exactly how quickly that's going to happen. For folks who don't live in the Outer Cape, cell reception isn't great out there. So that's one of the big questions, is how instantaneous is this alert going to be?
Because the buoy essentially is sending out a telephone call signal, a cell signal. But the question is how good a reception it has, and then the lifeguards who are on the beach are supposed to get this alert near instantaneously if it's working properly, and be able to let people know that a shark has been pinged right off that beach, or else it's sending out something like an email, these buoys. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of a question of, so once you have this technology, how do you implement it? If one goes by, do you automatically clear the water? That's some of the things that they're going to have to tackle. So they put one out in Newcomb Hollow out in Wellfleet. There's going to also be one out in Head of Meadow Beach out in Truro, and one at Nauset in Orleans, both places that sharks have been seen quite often off.
And it really is the first stage of any kind of shark detection technology to try to be deployed off the coast that connects the information sensors to people on the beach, like the lifeguards.
Yeah, and it's all experimental. Shark experts are saying this, hopefully, if a shark passes within 330 to 660 feet, the buoy would pick it up. It should be interesting to see what exactly happens. The one that's going to be going out in Wellfleet is going to be 20 feet, positioned 20 feet of water out a couple hundred yards. Full transparency here, there is only, like you said, 171 sharks. So if you're a shark that isn't tagged and you swim by, this buoy isn't going to do much for you. And I think there's twice, they've ID'd twice the amount of sharks that have been tagged. So yeah, I mean, this still isn't like a fail-safe method here.
Not yet, no. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker with Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. And Ethan, the governor has filed a very big transportation bond bill. It includes money for the Cape region. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this got kind of got lost in the shuffle. This was filed last week when we were in tornado mode. So he filed, yeah, this $18 billion transportation bond bill. So basically, this bill is, if passed, would give them the authorization to borrow this money, go out to bond for money for a bunch of projects. A lot of them are MBTA projects. The T isn't doing great, by all accounts. But for us down here, this could help. There's on the table, there's a $350 million bond for the infrastructure leading up to the two bridges, the Bourne and the Sagamore. So that's kind of the all the roads that lead up to both of those bridges.
And there's a big plan for this already. The Mass Department of Transportation has kind of come up with a set of preliminary recommendations for what to be doing here.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is right around the price tag that was previously estimated on those projects. So I think a lot of local legislators are pretty happy that they kind of actually put that number on the table. I mean, some of these things would be like changing some of the Bourne Rotary, adding extra lane on Route 6, changing Belmont Circle, moving 1C, adding a new place, a new ramp for 25. So it's a lot of things, but all of them are very contingent on the bridges being replaced, which the state, the governor has no real control over. That's all down to the federal government.
And that's a big, big price tag. That's $1 billion or so is what they say.
Yeah, yeah. We've heard numbers between 800 to a billion. I would assume probably it's going to get closer to the billion as we keep moving along here. But yeah, so this is kind of a welcome sight to a lot of people. Bond bills. So first of all, you just have the bills on the table. So that A has to make, these things have to make it through the regular legislative process. Once a bond bill actually happens, then they, just because it's in the bill doesn't mean you ever really go out to bond for it. I was talking to some legislators and they said there's things in bond bills that never went out to bond, or things that actually got passed that never went out to bond before. So it's kind of, first you have to get, stay inside the bill and get passed, then you actually go out to bond, and then these things are all dependent on another federal agency, which is still ongoing in their study and hasn't said, yes, we're going to replace them.
Well, is this sending a signal, though, to the federal government that the state is ready or has some, yeah, is ready to jump in here and support the project if it moves forward?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people I talked to had said this is kind of, they keep applying the pressure. The DOT study kind of signaled to the federal government that we want these bridges replaced. This is also kind of doing the same kind of thing. Keep saying, we're ready to move when you guys are.
Yeah. And the Corps, now the Corps has another study that's supposed to come out soon, which is essentially whether to repair, continue repairing the bridges or replace them.
Yeah, so the Corps has an ongoing study. It's been going on for quite a while now. I was told maybe about 2 summers ago that it was about to come out. And I'm told again this either late summer or fall it's supposed to come out again. So I wouldn't hold your breath, but that's the latest information on that. So, yeah, it's whether they're going to do this major rehab on these two bridges or if they're going to replace them. And some local legislators that I've talked to, basically, it's like a car. It's at what point do you stop throwing money into this old car and decide it's time to buy a new one? And they're pretty much all saying it's time to get some new ones.
And that's the Army Corps of Engineers who are responsible for that.
Correct.
A public meeting at the airport this week gave a chance for people to hear about the efforts there to address groundwater and soil contamination.
Yeah, so there's this chemical called PFAS that a lot of people are worried about. It's a man-made chemical that's been used in firefighting foam and some other things, including, I believe, in some airplane products and stuff out there. But basically, there's worries that these chemicals, which have been found both at the fire academy and the airport, are kind of leaching into the ground and getting into the water. Hyannis has had a couple warnings for kind of the most vulnerable populations, pregnant women, children, about the drinking water. So this is kind of keeping people informed and letting them kind of stay on top of this.
Because the airport is now trying to sort of wrap its arms around this problem, potential problem, and understand what they've got and what they have, how they have to respond.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a problem that a lot of airports are starting to figure out that they have. It's not just a Cape thing. Yeah, it's this ongoing effort, and it's people are learning more and more about PFAS as time goes by and realizing that they are probably not something you want right next to your water source.
And as the airport is developing a plan for this, they are taking public comment. So folks who are who would like to weigh in here, they have an opportunity to weigh in.
Yeah, yeah. Comments are you're able to comment until August 19th, so middle of this month. And it's I can.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's tell them. Out?
Yeah, so there's the one you can send them via email. It's sue.kennedy@town.barnstable.ma.us. And then you can also send it to the Barnstable Municipal Airport at the attention of the Public Involvement Plan, 480 Barnstable Road, Hyannis, Mass., 02601.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thanks so much for being here this morning. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Steve. Thank you.
We're going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, I want to start by asking you about storm cleanup from last week. You guys caught it pretty hard. What's the state of things now?
Sure. Give a rundown on a couple of our towns here. First of all, Harwich was, which was probably the worst hit, maybe of the whole Cape out of this whole thing. They estimated that there was $3.2 million worth of damage done in Harwich. Mostly that was trees and brush down, damage to property, houses, and some vehicles. You know, they still are actually removing trees and brush now. They estimated there were something like 3,000 trees that went down, and 1,300 of those were blocking roadways at one time or another. So that was a huge removal project that they accomplished. And a lot of that material ended up in the town landfill, where the town has gotten an estimate of over nearly $150,000 to remove that material, which they've been allowing people to bring in at no charge, and will continue that for another week or so. Cranberry Valley Golf Course lost 200 trees and were closed for they just reopened yesterday with nine holes, actually, and the other nine holes will open tomorrow. And they estimated that they lost, because of that closure, about $500,000. And there was also some $300,000 worth of damage done in the town's cemetery from both downed trees and damaged headstones. Now, Harwich Selectmen this week voted to authorize up to $1 million in deficit spending on storm cleanup. Chatham fared a little better. There was a lot of trees down. We still don't have a damage estimate from the town, but some 30 to 40 homes were damaged. There was a pole, utility pole, that went down on Homestead Lane, which is right near Mill Pond, and there was concern that some chemicals that contained PCBs that leaked out of the transformers that fell down might have gotten into the waters. There was the shell fishing in the area was closed, but they tested the water the other day and didn't find any PCBs, so that was reopened. There was some good news in Chatham, where some osprey chicks that had gotten knocked out of their nest when the pole fell, when their nesting pole fell down at Harding's Beach, they were returned by some Good Samaritans who restored the pole, and WildCare had taken care of the chicks while that was being done. And when the folks put the chicks back in the pole, the parents returned. So that was just a little bit of good news that we had.
It's a good story, yes.
So that's kind of the rundown of what we've found. We'll be continuing to follow the cleanup in both of our communities here.
Let me ask you about another story you have. The Chatham Bars Inn in the town of Chatham have settled a lawsuit that goes back to an action the town took almost about 5 years ago.
Sure. It was at the Chatham town meeting in 2014 that voters agreed to take a permanent easement over a piece of land about 10,000, a little over 10,000 square feet, The land is owned by Chatham Bars Inn, but it's adjacent to the lower parking lot at the town fish pier. And the town has actually been using that land since the 1950s under an agreement with the inn. But in the last decade or so, there have been some rocky relationships between the two entities, and the town decided that they needed to take a permanent easement in that property in order to ensure that the fishermen could continue to park their vehicles there. And CBI ended up taking the town to court over that. The town had initially offered $100,000 for that easement. CBI said it was worth a whole lot more than that. After 4 years, the two sides reached a settlement, and that's going to involve the town paying CBI an additional $300,000, so a total of $400,000, which is about half of what CBI was requesting and a little more than an appraisal that the town had on the property. The two entities have sort of come together recently. There's been a change in management at the inn, and there's been better relationships, and officials are attributing that to the ability to reach a settlement here. The inn says they'll use the additional money to do some upgrading on some of their properties, and the town is happy that fishermen will now have a permanent place to park down at the lower lot there. So, you know, that's some good news related to the fish pier. Of course, we've had a lot of negative news in recent months with the delays in the deck, which the observation deck there, which, as a side, is actually being constructed even as we speak. So even though they'll probably miss most of the summer season, that project is actually moving along at this point.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, Conservation Foundation has taken one of the island's two cranberry bogs out of operation. Tell us about this.
It has. Cranberries have been cultivated on Nantucket for more than 150 years, but part of that cultivation, some of the last of that cultivation, came to an end last week when the foundation closed down its windswept cranberry bog on Pulpus Road. Now, the goal is to transition that 37-acre bog into a wetland that would look and function in the same way that other inland wetlands do around the island that take in water and nutrients that flow into them and filter it before it flows back into Pulpus Harbor and Nantucket Harbor. It was a decision that the foundation made for environmental concerns due to poor water quality around Pulpus Harbor and the economic viability of the bog. They began harvesting organically in 2001, and that helped get a higher cost per pound for their cranberries, but Canadian production has really flooded the U.S. market in recent years, decreasing the value. More importantly for Foundation Executive Director Cormac Collier, however, the decision to stop the cultivation at the bog was more for environmental reasons. Even though they use organic methods, organic fertilizers and herbicides, those things that flow into the bog, from the bog into the harbor, even though they're organic, have an impact on the water quality around the area, Collier said, and they want to get away from that. And suspending the cultivation will enhance the harbor water quality by allowing these wetlands to filter the water that's flowing into it for stormwater and other water that flows into the marsh and then out into the harbor.
Another story here from the island, the town is preparing for a single-use plastics ban. This doesn't go into effect until June 2020, but the town is already starting to put some preparations in place.
They are. Both the town and the town's businesses are starting to prepare for this June 1st, 2020 deadline when many single-use plastic items will be, the sale of them, I should say, will be banned on the island. That's about 10 months away, and island businesses and restaurants are already starting to prepare. The Nantucket Hotel has done away with all of its plastic straws, forks, knives, cups, and bottles at the bar. The only thing they have single-use plastic left is the coffee pods. The Mid-Island Stop and Shop, which is one of the big places everybody thinks about when supermarkets, when you talk about a plastics ban, they've already started the move as well. They've overseen a shift from plastic to reusable and compostable products throughout the store in some places. They've already replaced much of the forks, knives, and spoons and containers at their salad bar with plant-based material products. Pretty much across the board, town officials on the end, the businesses are saying they want to take a proactive approach, really get the word out before this happens so it doesn't catch anybody by surprise. The Oceans Conservancy in Washington, D.C. has said that more than 3 million plastic straws are discarded each summer on Nantucket, part of more than 500 million daily across the country. So that's quite a few, and Nantucket has had a Stop the Straw campaign going on for quite some time now, even before the ban, encouraging but not mandating that restaurants and businesses convert from plastic straws to either reusable or compostable straws.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
With us now from the Provincetown Banner is Casey Myers. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve.
Casey, Massachusetts voters voted to legalize the sale of recreational marijuana in 2016. A lot of people in Provincetown are wondering, where is it? I think despite a lot of energy around this, they're still waiting for a shop to open up.
Yeah, Provincetown is looking to become the pot capital of Cape Cod. There are seven marijuana businesses that have community host green agreements with the select board to open shops in Provincetown, which is more than any other community. And it's also worth noting that the Outer Cape in general is the county's green isle. Aside from Mashpee and Brewster, East Ham, Wellfleet, Truro, and Provincetown are the only Cape towns to allow retail recreational sales of cannabis. So here in Provincetown, yeah, everything is in limbo, waiting for state licensing, according to the acting town manager. So in, he says that the holdup is purely about the state's process of going first to last. And that's what, so we're all waiting. Curaleaf, Massachusetts is one of the largest retailers in the, I think it's the largest retailer in the country right now. And it is one of the shops that's going to open, in fact, across from the banner at 170 Commercial Street. It's had a license, a local license, since November. It's also, renovations are complete, and it even has a sign outside the door. And I see many curious people all day look at the sign, then walk down the ramp, which is in the basement level, and try to read whatever they can find on the door, which right now has a text message. You can text and find out updates on when it's going to open. We actually did speak with someone from Curaleaf, Massachusetts, who said that they're hoping to be open in September. And, yeah.
So that's relatively soon if it's open, but they're going to miss the whole summer, all of these places.
Yeah, everybody, all these places miss the whole summer. Yep, absolutely. Curaleaf has been making a lot of news lately because it just acquired GR Companies, a Midwest firm that now makes it the largest retailer in the country. And they also got dinged by the FDA for making false claims about unproven CBD products and how they could treat ADHD or Parkinson's disease. And Curaleaf responded by removing all those claims from their website. But meanwhile, Joe Coffee, which is above the Curaleaf shop that's yet to open, sells a lot of their tinctures, a lot of the hemp tinctures made by Curaleaf. And so, yeah, so it's very interesting. And they say they sell out of them very quickly.
So all these shops that are poised to open, you say seven shops in Provincetown are kind of lined up to open, but they need approval from the state. But the state doesn't have any timeline for when this might happen. They're just working their way through these applications, and they can't even give people a sense of when this is going to happen?
No, I don't think so, at least not to our knowledge.
Yeah.
And another thing that's going to be interesting is one of the local licensing regulations is that these shops all have to be open year-round, and the upfront investment to open them with security and everything else is huge. So it's certainly going to be an economic challenge to see how people are going to be able to make these investments and then stay open all winter long.
Casey, yes, we'll have to wait and see, because there is no recreational marijuana store open on Cape Cod right now. The nearest one is in Wareham.
That's right, exactly.
Casey Myers. I'll... Oh, yeah, sorry, Casey. What's that? Go ahead and tell me.
Okay, I was just going to say, The town manager, before he left, he estimated that Provincetown could get anywhere from $120,000 to $250,000 a year in retail tax from the marijuana shops.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Hey, Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Have a nice day.
This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us on the phone from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. George, bus drivers for the Vineyard Transit Authority are back at work after a month-long strike. When we last talked to you last Friday, they had just come to a tentative agreement. Bring us up to date here.
Yeah, so on Sunday, the drivers held a vote at the vineyard, and they got together, and it was actually by ballot, which was interesting. And so the drivers went in one by one, cast their ballot. There were 48 eligible drivers, 32 voted yes, and only one voted no. You know, it's a secret ballot, so we don't know who voted no. But yeah, this ends not just the month-long strike, but it ends a contentious period for the union and the Vineyard Transit Authority. They were just not seeing eye to eye on this. Actually, it's the company Transit Connection Incorporated,
right.
TCI, we call them. They're the parent company of the drivers, and they were at odds really for 5 years. This ends a five-year back and forth legal struggle, first to even form a union and now to get a contract settled. And the drivers are pleased with the settlement. They didn't get everything that they wanted, but they did get significant pay increases. And they also got some things that they have been looking for in terms of seniority, being able to, you know, senior drivers being able to select routes, and drivers being paid for some of their holiday shifts, more for them anyway. They obviously were being paid, but weren't being paid what other people are paid on holidays. So it brings this contentious battle to an end. You know, if I had to say what the turning point was, I think it was a contentious meeting a couple of weeks ago where some local officials actually got involved and talked to the VTA advisory board and said how this was affecting some of their workers, some of their constituents who rely on this. You know, for much of the strike, something called Medivan had been eliminated. This is a service that's provided. You know, seniors pay a fee, and Medivan will take them to off-island medical appointments, for example. And a great service for them, and once it wasn't operating, they were out of luck. No way to get to these appointments. So that was putting a real strain on people. And so they had this contentious meeting and ultimately voted at that meeting to demand that TCI go back to the table. And then within a couple of days, they hammered things out. Sometimes all it takes is that push. And, you know, there's been a little bit of tension since they got back.
I was going to say, I'm curious to know what happens. I mean, there seemed like there was so much tension throughout this strike, obviously. And even, as you say, like the 5 years preceding this, with the company really pushing back against any effort to unionize, and then and then when the union came into play, not wanting to negotiate with them, and here they are, they've gotten through this. What happens now? Do they just kind of all shake hands and say we're friends, or what?
Yeah, I think it's going to take time. Like with anything, you know, you have to lick your wounds, right? One of the drivers told us when they returned to work on Tuesday that there was a notice in the day room that they use. Saying that there had been personal attacks, but now was the time for reconciliation. You know, the drivers don't feel like there were personal attacks. They feel like, you know, they were just looking out for themselves. So, it's going to take some time, as I said. But everything seems to be operating pretty well. You know, Brian Dowd, who's been covering this from the very beginning, took a ride the very first morning. Some of the commuters were really happy to see this particular driver, Roland Goulart, back behind the wheel. And, you know, he was happy to be there. And, you know, he has a good relationship with some of the regular riders. And, you know, that showed that morning.
There must be a sense of relief on the island.
Absolutely. You know, this is the busiest time of year. You know, July is busy in its own right. But August, you know, is even busier. There are some big events here. You know, we have Beach Road Weekends coming up next weekend. There's the OB Fireworks.
The Ag Fair is coming up.
Ag Fair, absolutely. So there's all these events in August that, you know, people depend on, you know, this bus service to get to and from them. So they're not adding to the clogging of the roads. So, yeah, big sigh of relief here.
Hey, you just mentioned Brian Dowd, who was covering this for you. Brian Dowd has a nice story in the paper this week about how his grandfather Then a young reporter covered the sinking of the Andrea Doria and may even have taken a Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, when Brian told me this story, I said, we have to get this into print, Brian. It's an incredible story. His grandfather was a reporter for a paper called The Boston Traveler. And, of course, everybody knows the story of the Andrea Doria, so I won't go into details about that. But his father and a photographer were assigned to go and cover the sinking.
It's an ocean. Just briefly, it's an ocean liner that sank off the coast of Nantucket, and we have an anniversary of that sinking, right?
Right, right. That was last Thursday. And so Brian's grandfather and the photographer were a little late to the story, and you know, all these other photographers they saw coming back into Nantucket Airport with their cameras, with their photos, and they were going off to press, and this photographer was so worried he was going to lose his job. They finally hooked up with a Martha's Vineyard pilot out of Katama, and he came over and got them up in the air, but it turns out the photographer got motion sickness, and he didn't bring his Dramamine with him. And so he was not feeling great on the flight. Also, he had picked to be in the front seat, which wasn't the best vantage point. So Brian's grandfather grabbed the camera at one point and started snapping pictures out the window of the plane that they were on. And they got this dramatic photo that won the Pulitzer Prize. The funny thing is, the photographer won the Pulitzer Prize for it, but they're absolutely not certain who took that photograph. It could have very well been Brian's grandfather. Nonetheless, he was there for a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo, and it is quite a dramatic photo.
It's a great photo. You've got it there. I was looking it on the website, and it's a great story. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Enjoy this great day.
Yes. With me in the studio right now is Eve Zuckoff, our WCAI's environmental reporter. I was just going to say our environmental reporter. Everybody, you're the environmental reporter for our listeners.
I'm
welcome,
here for the
Eve.
People, Steve. Hi, how are you?
This week, you attended what's called the One Cape Summit in Harwich. Tell us about the event. Tell us what it is first and who was there.
Yeah, so it's put on by the Cape Cod Commission, and it was a pretty amazing turnout. There's 350 leaders from the public, private, nonprofit sector. So town managers, working with bankers, working with, you know, state officials, even like Daniel Seeger, the Massachusetts Undersecretary of Environmental Affairs. And it was really an opportunity for all of these leaders to talk about ways to balance the Cape's kind of growing list of environmental challenges like coastal erosion, high tide flooding, water quality, intense storms, with the realities and untapped possibilities of the economy. So it was really environment, economy, how do we find solutions? How do we build resilience on the Cape?
Now, I'm curious, this was in Harwich, and all of this is coming just a week after, not even a full week after the three tornadoes touched down on the Cape, doing considerable damage. How much were folks talking about that event?
Yeah, it definitely framed the entire event. But it came up in different ways. You know, some people joked about the serendipity of the tornado and this conference, you know, got some laughs. Other eye rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had, you know, Mike Keneally, the Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development. He took this conference as an opportunity to actually announce a $1 million grant to small local businesses affected by the tornado. But actually the one that stood out to me was from Eric Fisher, chief meteorologist for WBZ. He was the second speaker of the whole event. So he really kicked it off and laid out the case for climate change here. He basically said, you know, warming ocean temperatures add more fuel to storms, so a hurricane develops faster and gets stronger, which means, and this is a direct quote, when we get a strong hurricane in New England, a tornado will look like nothing.
Mm.
So really, it was a warning shot. I think the tornado framed it, the conference like that.
And when you talk about how the climate change is contributing to intensifying storms that way, There's also this, this the Cape becoming more vulnerable as its buffer is kind of sinking because of ocean level rise, too. So you have to wonder, all these towns must be focused on and how they can respond to this. What kinds of things did you hear about that?
Yeah, the summit was really built around innovation, around resilience. So some people talked about the public policy solutions. Others talked about developing coastal infrastructure, like, for example, putting in more protection actually on beaches, on the dunes. I heard people talk about new ways to clean and use stormwater and wastewater through absorbent plants, for example. But the conversations really ran the gamut from climate change response to prevention on the Cape.
We have just a few minutes here, and I want to get to something that happened last week before the tornadoes, which was we had a two-part series on right whales and vessel strikes. And you reported this, and it was a nice story. Landed Monday and Tuesday, and then we got the tornado, and it got overshadowed a little bit. But these are our endangered right whales, the ones that show up around Nantucket and in Cape Cod Bay each winter and spring. There are just about 400 of these left in the world, and these whales, they still face death by entanglement in fishing gear, but it seems that recently vessel strikes have become a bigger factor in their deaths. You wanted to examine this. Now, most, if not all, of the recent vessel strikes are happening in Canada, is that right?
That's right. And actually, if I can just give you, these are numbers, so bear with me for a second, but I think they're really important to framing the issue of vessel strike deaths. Basically, in the last 2 years alone, 20 North Atlantic right whales have been found dead in Canadian waters. And of the 11 that could be necropsied or their corpses, their carcasses studied, 7 were found to have died as a result of vessel strikes. And, you know, for years we had been seeing these whales die after getting entangled in fishing gear and rope. And that pendulum is just shifting the other way.
There are a number of factors at play here, and you sort of unpacked them for us in this series. You talked to people who, the mariners themselves, and what the challenges are for mariners navigating these waters around whales.
Yeah, so for that, I actually talked to Captain Michael Burns. He's an academic director at the Mass Maritime Academy in Bourne. And he, you know, he headed up 650-foot ships for the government for 14 years. And he talked about how difficult it is to detect whales. Basically, you're relying on sight because whales don't show up on most electronic charts or radar screens. They're just too close to the surface to do that. So at night, they're nearly impossible to see. They also only breach once an hour to breathe sometimes. And then even if mariners do see them, ships don't have brakes. They're not like cars. It takes a while to really slow them down and stop them. And then biologists told me on the flip side, from the perspective of whales, they in their evolutionary history, we don't exactly know why they're not dodging ships, dodging these large vessels. But the feeling is that they probably never had to dodge anything in their evolutionary history before. And in order to learn from their mistakes, they have to actually survive. And it seems that they're not. These are catastrophic events when they're struck by ships.
Now, one of the big things here is why these whales are moving north and why they're finding them in the shipping lanes in Canada. And this does have to do with climate change.
Yes, this is, I'm kind of obsessed with this part of the story. So basically, North Atlantic right whales eat these crustaceans. They're called copepods. They're teeny tiny grains of rice-sized things. It's their favorite food. And for decades, or at least since the 1970s, North Atlantic right whales would spend their summers in Canadian waters like the Bay of Fundy, feasting on these copepods. But the numbers of copepods have fallen in the Bay of Fundy in recent years. So basically, the whales left. They were looking for waters with higher concentrations. And the reason that they left was that the copepods weren't thriving in those waters anymore because they were too warm.
The waters are starting to warm.
That's climate change.
So they're moving, the whales are following this food, it's thriving further north in cooler waters.
Exactly. So they actually moved into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and where they've moved this year to get this higher concentration is right in the middle of these really busy shipping lanes.
It's a two-part series. You can find that on our website. Eve Zuckoff, thanks for coming in, talking about One Cape and about the right whales.
Thank you, Steve.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.